Welcome to the WA Laparoscopic and Obesity Surgery podcast. In this podcast, we will be sharing information from one of Australia's leading bariatric surgeons, Dr. Kevin Dolan. You can expect live interviews with patients, tips from the doctor himself, and useful information from our dietitians and other support team members. Join us on our weight loss podcast as we go through the weight loss journey. Let's get it started.
Okay, Sabrina, welcome to the Kevin Dolan podcast. Can you just give us a, obviously you work with Kevin at the practice and you're one of his main dietitians. Can you just give me a little bit of a background on your journey in the world of health and dietetics?
Sure. So firstly, thanks for having me. My journey in dietetics, I'm going to give you the short version, but I guess my passion for dietetics started at a very young age. So I was actually born, I'm Italian. I was born in South Africa. I was born in Joburg and we immigrated to Australia. And I would now look at myself and say that I completely ate my feelings. In saying that, I did gain quite a lot of weight. I stopped playing sport when we immigrated. It was a bit of a difficult time. Right. And my mum decided I was in year seven. So I think I might have been like 11 or 12 at the time. And my mum took me to see a dietitian. And she asked me what was my favorite food. And I replied, choc chip cookies. And she said, well, that's great, but you can't eat them every day. Yeah. But if you do want to eat them, these are the best options. And if you don't, you can make them and you can make them a lot healthier. And then they're better for you. Right. So that kind of sparked a little bit of a little fire inside me to say, okay, well, if I can eat what I want, but I just have to make smarter choices, you know, that's actually not too bad. And then as my passion for science and how the body worked, and I think the body's just phenomenal and how the, you know, body functions, is just amazing. And that kind of grew, it kind of became a no-brainer to figure out like how food works with the body and how people can adapt and learn from that to make better, smarter choices. So for me, it was kind of like a no-brainer that this is the pathway to go. Obviously uni, first job out, I did a lot. As a dietitian, jobs are very scarce out there. So you pick up everything you can. So I was probably doing three or four things at the time. So a little bit of community. I did work a little bit more rurally as well, which was really quite nice and very different in comparison to like a urban city hospital kind of center.
Yeah.
Which was a really great experience. I loved every minute of that. I've done quite a bit of things with kids and childcare centres, reteaching childcare centres how to like evaluate menus and reassess so they can have better nutrition for the kids that they're looking at. Sure. And for after-school care. Then went in from there to a little bit more private practice, was in private practice for a good 4-5 years.
Yeah.
And I think I've been with Kevin for about 3.5. So journey, and then from private practice, that was everything from kids to eating disorders to bariatrics, so food intolerances. So it was just a bit of everything, which is really good. It just really, I guess, gets you to think outside the box. And now obviously focusing more so on the bariatric side in the last 3-4 years, which has been a really nice change, so a little bit more clinical. Right. So that's kind of been my journey. So a bit of everything. So
why bariatric? What sort of what do you find fulfilling about working with bariatric patients?
For me, I think bariatric patients, like by the time our bariatric patients get into our office, they've tried everything. Mm. Like they've been around the garden a couple of times. It's certainly not like they wake up one morning and go, great, I'm going to have a sleeve. I'm going to have 75% of my stomach removed. Like that's not like, the first thought that someone goes through. So by the time they get to me, it's more of like as if this is their last chance. They're kind of defeated. They've tried everything else. And I guess it's the enjoyment and I guess the self-satisfaction and I guess work satisfaction of seeing someone and being able to give them the tools to say, you know what, hey, like you can do this. Let's use this as a bit of a tool. We can keep changing this and that. And then seeing how their life can progress and seeing like the health benefits, the decrease in like blood sugars, insulin, cholesterol, like like I've had people on insulin then come off insulin, like that yeah. life-changing that moments. And then like one patient of mine, who if she listens to this, she'll know who I'm talking about, but is 3 or 4 years post-surgery and she has stayed stable. She's had kids and she's lost the weight and she's like, we've gone through the pregnancies together. So I guess it becomes yeah. more of a, like you build a relationship with a person and I guess you get invested and seeing them succeed and seeing them be happier, healthier people who are now finding quality life or more quality in their life and they're comfortable and they're more confident. That's, I guess that's the reason what draws me to bariatrics.
Very cool. If you had one main health message, that you could give to all your patients or people who are even considering bariatric surgery, what would that main message be?
Probably that it's not a quick fix. Like harsh but true, I guess. The thing I find, like, people who haven't had bariatric surgery will go, oh, it's a cop-out. It's the easy way out. Bariatrics is so not easy. So going through and having any of the surgeries, it's not an easy process. It's like mentally and emotionally very challenging. It's very different to be able to drink a glass of water to the next day waking up and it's taking you 30 minutes or an hour to get through a little medicine cup.
Yeah.
So like that change becomes difficult and the process isn't easy. So that, I guess, would probably be the biggest message. But in saying that, I'll be honest, I have had one patient regret it in 4 years and I don't think so. That's a pretty good, I can't say I haven't had no one regret it. Yeah. That would be me lying.
Yeah.
But he was a much older patient and I think mentally he just wasn't ready to make those changes that – those lifestyle changes. So I kind of say, I guess, biggest message is if you're thinking about it, it isn't easy, but it is a huge opportunity that you can get to, I guess, restart your life, re-listen to your body, reset yourself up and really, I guess, make your life live a bit longer.
Yeah.
I mean, and yeah, it can really just help so much so with so many other like health conditions, not just weight in itself, like weight's weight, but it's all the other things that impact life that needs to be taken into consideration.
Yeah. I have to say, I think you're absolutely right in saying there is that sort of misconception in the world that, oh, this is an easy route out. And I think it's really important what you said. This is still a intensive journey and you do have
absolutely.
To be mentally prepared for it.
For sure. Yeah.
All right. Thank you, Sabrina, for spending time with us on the Kevin Dolan podcast. Let's get straight into it.
Great. Thank you.
I'd like to know, do I need to lose a percentage of body weight prior to surgery? And if I do, why is that the case?
Not really. We don't recommend this, or we don't need you to lose a specific amount of weight. There is a certain weight limit that we do at our surgery recommend. So yes, if you're above that, we do like you to lose so that you fit into our weight category. But if you do already fit into that and you're eligible for surgery, we don't actually require a certain amount of weight to be lost before you go in. Mainly because a little bit of the fact that we know your whole lifestyle is going to change, so there will be so many changes after. And we do put you on a pre-op diet anyway. This does sometimes bring about weight loss, but a certain number or a certain percentage we don't necessarily get you to aim before you go in. Everything just becomes a little bit of a bonus. The pre-op diet that we do end up putting you on, it is more so for shrinking the liver and just making the surgery a lot safer. And also does do like more of a mental prep because you're going to be on fluids after surgery. It allows you to get your mind into a little bit of a better mentality that you won't be able to eat your 3 meals a day and snacks and everything else. So it's more of a mental prep and a more of a internal body prep that we need rather than an actual weight loss.
Can you give me an idea of what that prep actually looks like?
So we do use a very low-calorie diet and we recommend OptiFast. It is the only, I guess, meal replacement range that has been through evidence-based research shown that it puts the liver into what we call ketosis, into a form that it uses its own energy sources, and it stops the body from using anything else. This helps that liver shrink. So it really depends on where you sit, depends on what your blood readings say, will depend on, I guess, the strictness or the severity of your pre-op. So you could either be on two Optifast meals and then given a meal,
right,
or three Optifast meals and no meals and just some vegetables. Or you could be on your four Optifast meals as well as like a protein and veg option. So it does change depending on the individual.
And is that dependent upon which surgery they're going to have or just based on the initial weight that they come to you on?
The initial weight and their liver results.
Why is it important, I guess, to minimize the liver pre-surgery?
So where the liver actually sits, so as we gain weight, the liver is a fascinating organ. It actually grows. So as we put on weight, the liver can actually expand, which becomes slightly problematic because where it sits, it can actually start covering the stomach. So if we can get the liver to shrink as much as we can, wow, it actually makes it visually easier to see the stomach and do the surgery.
Okay.
So, yeah, so if we don't get it to shrink and let's say, it has happened in the past. Mm. If we cannot see and it's not safe, the surgery will not go on. So we will close.
Right. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So it's more of a safety procedure, yeah, than anything.
That makes sense. Now, you've spoken about what foods or drinks should be consumed before surgery. Tell me a little bit about post-surgery, what type of food should be consumed.
Sure. So this does depend on which surgery takes place. And in the dietetic pre-consult, we'll definitely go through this a lot more in detail. But your first 2 weeks is usually a fluid diet. In hospital, you're on what we call a clear fluid. So things that it is the consistency of water and you can see through it. So water, broths, you could do a bit of apple juice and some diet cordial, or black tea or coffee is pretty much the limitation of what they give you while you're in hospital. So it is just clear.
Right.
When we get home for 2 weeks after surgery for healing purposes, we do put you on a fluid and a fluid only diet. So we don't recommend any chewing whatsoever. Depending again on assist or what happens in surgery, 9 times out of 10, you can come home and transition to nourishing fluids. So that would be things that are more like milky-based consistencies, drinking yogurts. You could make like smoothies, but they're not allowed to have any seeds in them, any lumps or bumps. So pretty much like water consistency, you just don't see through it.
Right.
So, yep. So, and we do recommend a nutritional supplement just to make sure that you're actually getting nutrition in those 2 weeks rather than living on water and broth doesn't really give you much nutrition. So we do need to make sure within those 2 weeks of nourishing we get what we call nutritional supplements. So we can use the Optifast again if patients still have them left over.
Okay.
Or there's a few other products we can use. And this gives the body the protein and the energy it needs to kind of function correctly.
Okay.
In the 2 weeks.
And then after that 2 week mark, is there still limitations to what they can and cannot eat, or?
There is to some extent. So if you're looking at a band patient after 2 weeks on fluids, we will then go through and progress them to what we call puree and then soft diet, and then they touch base with us.
Okay.
So before they see us again, they're pretty much back up to what we would call normal foods, back to normal eating, just eating slowly. And at that time, all the swelling should go down and they should be able to tolerate all foods. We do then tighten, and then again, things go back and change and so on from there. A sleeve and a bypass do work differently. We do touch base with our sleeve and our bypasses 2 weeks after surgery, so after the 2 weeks of fluids, and then we go through how to transition back onto normal foods. It takes another 4 weeks from then. So from surgery to eating normally, it'll take about a bypass or a sleeve patient about 6 weeks.
Right. Okay. Now, after having surgery, and this may be a procedure specific, are there just big no-nos or foods that you can never re-enter back into your diet?
Yes and no. Depends on how strict, I guess, I'm being with my patients at the time. But I guess your big no-nos are, we do obviously look for a low-fat, low-sugar diet. Healthy eating in general is really where we like to go towards. The biggest no-no coming through is we don't recommend anything carbonated. Okay. And that's for any three surgeries, and that is for life after surgery. So that is a big one that people think, oh, after a couple of years we can still have. Mm-hmm. And the problem with carbonation, it actually puts pressure on the stomach wall and causes that pressure and that stretch to happen. So then people are able to eat a little bit more. So we do take out bubbles completely or anything carbonated, and that is for life after surgery. So that's probably the one huge no-no that is across the board with all three surgeries that doesn't change.
Okay. Now, another thing I think that's sort of synonymous with weight loss or dieting is calorie counting. As part of post-surgery sort of follow-up, does calorie counting come into play? Is that an important thing for our patients to review on an ongoing basis? Or so how does that sort of work post-surgery?
So post-surgery calorie counting for our surgery patients becomes a little difficult. Mm-hmm. There's no way you would ever hit like a low calorie diet just because of the portions you're then able to eat after surgery. I do have patients who prefer to record and who prefer to calorie count. I don't recommend it just because if you look at any app, MyFitnessPal is a very popular app to use. It'll always come up that you're not eating enough, and people do get quite worried that they're not getting the nutrition that they need and things like that.
Yeah.
And it becomes a little bit, I think, a little bit too obsessive.
So I
don't recommend calorie counting. There's definitely ways that we can make sure you're getting in the nutrition that you need, I guess, through food combinations is what I call them.
Cool.
And then, but the one thing we do get patients to count is their protein intake. And that's usually done at their third visit with us.
Okay.
And we actually work out a specific amount of protein that they need. And we teach them how to do that, and they get a protein counter. So when we run through that, so that's probably the only thing I do get them to calculate.
Right.
Yeah, after surgery.
Why is it important specifically to monitor how much protein you're intaking?
So protein becomes probably one of the most important things after surgery. If you don't get enough protein, we tend to lose too much muscle mass. So after surgery, or any weight loss, I guess, if you're going through it, you will always lose fat mass and muscle mass at the same time. The body won't be able just to lose one and not the other. So if you're losing both and you don't give your body enough protein coming in, your body will tend to put the brakes on, and your body will actually stop losing weight because it thinks that you're starving it because it's gone through too much muscle mass. So it'll actually just stop losing, and that's when people find that they stabilize for about 2, 3, or even 4 weeks. 9 times out of 10 it is because they're not getting enough protein in. So getting in that protein allows the body to replenish that muscle mass that's lost, rebuild that muscle, and it allows it, I guess, to feel safe enough to use the stored fat mass. I mean, fat mass is really there for, you know, those emergency aspects. So if the body doesn't need to use it, it'll break down other things as well as fat mass. So it's really important to make sure that it's getting that muscle to, or that protein to maintain the muscle mass.
Okay.
Well, so that can break down your fat mass.
Besides, I guess, the importance of protein, are there any other preventative measures that we can take to ensure the success of the surgery itself?
Protein, as you mentioned, is one big one. The other one that we do find the best results from patients that the best results we get, I guess, are from patients that always tend to come back. So constant follow-up both with Dr. Doland and our dietetic team. We do also have a bariatric physician that works with us, so we've got a really nice solid team. So people who tend to regularly come back tend to be a little bit more successful in the way, because I guess if they've got the questions, they've got the concerns, they do. Especially bariatric patients out there, some of them will find that the weight will either stall or they'll start to rebound a little bit, especially towards the 12 and 18 month mark, and they just won't come back for so many reasons. But that's kind of where you guys, or when they do need to come back to see us, just because we've got some answers, we've got tools, we can assist, and we should be, like, it's our job to make it easy for that weight to come off and for it to stay off. So I guess I always tell my patients in my consults that dietitians, and, you know, especially the ones that work with Kevin, our job is to give them and our patients as many tools as possible. So once that weight comes off, it's easy to maintain, and that lifestyle keeps just rotating what they've been doing the couple of months, because there's no point getting you to a weight and then going, great, now let's change everything, and you feel like you're dieting again. That's so not part of the surgery. So the surgery is more like a tool to give you a bit of a booster and then to get those lifestyle changes rolling through. And then, as I said, constant coming back and touching base with us, touching base with Dr. Dolan, and just really kind of, I guess, sets a patient up for some really good long-term habits anyway. The best, statistics that came out, I think actually it was about 4 or 5 years ago, was if you're two years post-surgery, if you've kept the weight off, you're actually 70% likely to keep it off for life.
Right.
If you're five, you're 90% likely to keep it off for life. So I kind of say to my patients, look at it like a five-year plan.
Yeah.
So first couple of years, or first year, 18 months, 2 years, you see us quite regularly. After that, it's a once a year touch base. And after 5 years, we look at you and we go, yeah, you're pretty much good to go.
Okay.
So yeah, if patients can think about it that way, it's a really good way to kind of plan it, I guess.
So what are your, just to unpack that even further, what are your recommendations for visits over the first sort of 2 year period?
So, your initial would be, I guess, usually 2 weeks or more before surgery.
Right.
Then you've got your follow-up 2 weeks after, or if you're a band, 4 weeks after surgery.
Right.
My band patients, I tend to see every 4, 8, or 12 weekly.
Okay.
My sleeves and my bypasses, it depends. So usually after that third session, I get, the second follow-up being the 2 weeks post.
Yeah.
Then I tend to see my patients 6 weeks after that to discuss their protein intake.
Right.
Then after that, it becomes, depending on how often they need me, every 4, 6, 8, or 12 weekly for the first year. And then I usually jump to the 6 month mark.
Cool. And then that 6 month mark, you recommend happening every, for life, or?
Usually for the first 2 years. So usually then after the first couple, I'll probably end up going, let's say, a 3 month review.
Yeah.
And then you could probably go 6 months, and then you'll probably see them at what I'd call their year post.
Cool.
And then if everything's going quite well, we'll flick to their 18 month post. So 6 months after that, and then 2 year, and then once a year.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
And you're saying that those patients that follow that sort of follow up process, they're having, in most cases, the most success with their weight loss journey.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Cool. Okay. What I'd like to do now is I'd like to move into, I guess, understanding nutrition. So Sabrina, give me a bit of an idea of what you would consider a healthy diet to look like, or your version of an ideal meal. That may be a difficult question to answer.
Yeah, it's a little bit of a tricky one. Okay. So I guess I'll give you two scenarios. Yeah. One as a bariatric patient, obviously it's a bariatric one, and one as a non-bariatric. So anyone else is listening, or I guess family and friends of bariatric patients.
Yeah.
So an ideal, or my, I guess, ideal look of a meal or of what a diet would really be, a combination or a balance of both carbs, protein, fruit, veg, and your healthy good fats. So it really is, I guess, that lovely saying of moderation is key.
Mm.
A bit of everything, but especially when you are looking at meals, carbohydrates are good. Obviously, there are certain carbohydrates that are better for the bodies than others. And looking at those good carbohydrates, making sure you're getting good quality protein in, so some lean protein, and of course your fruit and your veg. So, and that would be at each meal. So that would be obviously for a non-bariatric.
Mm.
Bariatric definitely does focus a lot more on the protein side of things. So I guess if you were looking at a plate, half of your meal should really be protein.
Right.
Then the other, I guess, three quarters would have been your veg. And then you get like a, maybe a tablespoon or two of carbohydrate. And that would be what a meal, a long-term bariatric patient's meal would end up looking like. So I'm still balanced. So still getting the same, you know, carb, protein, veg, just proportionally different. So our focus is always going to be slightly higher on your protein side.
Right. Okay. Now we've spoken briefly about the whole calorie counting concept. What can you explain to us, I guess, what calories even are and I guess just how perhaps the world has sort of become so focused on it, because I think it's super interesting that protein for our bariatric patients seems to be more of a priority of this idea of calorie counting. So maybe if we can just explain what that even means.
Sure. Calories are pretty much energy. So if we look at calories of bits of energy that the body uses, that's probably the best way to look at what a calorie actually is. Calories and kilojoules are the exact same thing.
Right.
They're both energy. To give a bit of a breakdown, one calorie is equal to about 4.2 kilojoules. So that's why you'll always see those two listed on packaging. But they're the exact same thing, just we use kilojoules mostly, and so does the UK. In America, they usually use calories. I personally like calories better. It's a smaller number to work with. It's a lot nicer.
Yeah.
But it is just a form of energy. Now, I guess depending on then that food, like if you're looking at, I'm going to say a muesli bar, for example, you'll have your carbs, your protein, your fat. Now, carb, protein, and fat all will give you a certain amount of energy. Those energies added together will produce your total energy for that meal, which would be your calorie count.
Okay.
So when people count calories, I guess the biggest mistake is that, granted, yeah, calories in, calories out, so you've got your expenditure, you'll always get a deficit. But it's actually important where those calories are coming from.
Right.
Because if you were only allowed a diet, let's say, for instance, with 400 or 500 calories and you chose to eat 2 Mars bars that covered that, nutritionally you're not going to get anything, and you might find a couple of days you do lose, but then you will start to gain because your body's not getting the nutrition that it needs. So it's really dependent on where those calories then actually come from. An important thing with that being with protein is people, and especially our bariatric patients, are really quite scared of carbohydrates. And probably a lot of people out there think carbs are what would they call, I guess, bad foods or weight gainers of foods. But if you had to actually look at the energy that a carb gives you and an energy that protein gives you, and you're looking at 1 gram of each of those, they give you the same amount of energy.
Right.
Which is kind of mind-blowing.
Yeah.
So, so really one's actually not better than the other.
Right.
They're actually exactly the same in energy value. It's what the body does with them that's important. So, and that's the other reason I'm not a huge fan, as we just discussed before, of calorie counting.
Yeah.
Because it's more so where those calories are coming from and what that body needs, depending on whatever state it's in, will depend on which, you know, maybe it is better for you to have more carbohydrates, let's say after exercise, to replenish that energy loss. But if you're a bariatric patient and you haven't had anything for 4 or 5 hours, you're going to have lost muscle mass, so protein's key. So it really depends, I guess, on the situation, the person, what calorie proportion someone should be having depending on where those calories are coming from.
Right. So
does that kind of answer your question?
That definitely does.
Yes?
I guess I'm quite interested in, so what would be the circumstance, just so to differentiate the, I guess, the importance of protein and carbohydrates, what do the two do for your body? Like, are carbohydrates better for long-term energy release or protein short-term? What are they most useful for?
Perfect. Absolutely. So you kind of like hit the nail on the head. Carbohydrates give you the energy, I guess, to do whatever your body needs to do.
Right.
Your main source of energy for your brains, your muscles, your heart, and your lungs to function, they like what we call glucose. Carbohydrates, when broken down by the body, produce glucose. So our first form, I guess, of energy usage is always going to be glucose. So your body will always use the carbohydrates first. Protein, on the other hand, is broken down into what we call amino acids. Now, amino acids are actually uptaken into muscles to help rebuild muscles. So they won't just rebuild like your bicep and tris and things like that, but it is, I guess, assisting in muscle function, muscle repair, all those kind of things that come in. So everything internally, being your organs and muscles, need amino acids to, I guess, repair and keep themselves at optimum functioning level.
Right.
So your muscle will be repaired by the amino acid, but the glucose will provide the energy for that muscle to contract, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
So both are actually needed. If there's no carbohydrate, your body will adapt and it will use different energy sources to get what it needs.
Right. Okay.
Yeah.
Very interesting. To carry on from that, give me a bit of an idea of, I guess, what does the consumption of food look like, I guess, internally? So how is food digested?
Short or long version. I'll give you the nice simple version.
Cool.
As soon as food goes into the stomach, so as I mentioned, you've got your three majors. So your carbohydrates, your protein, your fat, your fruits and your veg are quite easily digested. They're more so just based on fiber. But the other three tend to be the three big major, I guess, what they call your macronutrients. In the stomach kind of turns like a concrete mixer. So the body will actually release what we call chyme. So it will turn it into chyme. So it will end up, I guess, releasing acidity and enzymes to break down the food. Protein is broken down and so is carbohydrates. So if you had to look at, let's say, like, you know, one of those little kids beads that you kind of swing the, I think it's called like one of the abacus things.
Yes. Yeah.
If you know what I'm talking about. If you look like a row with beads on it, what tends to happen is the body actually, and these enzymes will actually just halve these beads. So they'll be broken down into a smaller amount of, or a simpler sugar, I guess, of carbohydrates and a simpler amino acid from protein. That all happens in the stomach. Okay.
Right.
And that's very acidic. When it then goes into the small intestine and it goes into the duodenum, another product is released called bile. That kind of changes the whole enzyme as it's traveling down into the duodenum. And once it hits into the duodenum, which is the first part of the small intestine, it changes and it's extremely basic. And by then, with the bile coming through, breaks down fat. So that's when the fat kind of gets broken down.
Right.
After that goes into the small intestine, because all of those products have been broken up into the smaller sugars, your small intestines will then absorb those, and it kind of works like a lock and key system. So it'll match up, it's got a receptor to the food, and it kind of scans and goes, yep, you're mine, and it opens up and the body absorbs it. The things that don't really get absorbed are what I mentioned a little bit before with your fruit and veg with fiber, and it's called insoluble fiber, and that tends to go into the bowel.
Right.
So once that absorption happens, it goes into the body, just tends to use it, bloodstream, breaks it down further, and et cetera.
Yeah.
Does that make it a little bit more simple?
Yes, it does.
You know where everything kind of breaks down?
How okay. It all works. Now, I read one of your food messages is don't believe everything you read and don't eliminate any food groups. I am interested in knowing, because I think one of the most difficult things either for bariatric or non-bariatric patients is just understanding nutritional information or food labels, or, you know, how to do the grocery shopping. Give me a bit of an idea of how, or even if it's necessary, to read food labels.
Sure. That is a really big message of mine. So, because I think there's so much misinformation out there, and especially when patients get into our office, they've heard everything. They've tried everything.
Yeah.
I mean, and it really is just, I kind of just keep saying to them, like, I'm going to throw a couple of spanners into the works. And people get really kind of taken back because there's so much misinformation. Label reading is one that I guess can be misinformed as well. So it's something that we do definitely take time with during consults to go through and have our patients really thoroughly understand what they're looking out for. And it's mainly because a lot of them will have like nutritional claims that can sometimes be misleading. A lot of the food standards have actually tried to eliminate that. So if it actually is claiming to do something, let's say like high protein, it should actually be high in protein, for example. It's not allowed to just state it anymore, which is a lot better than what it used to be back in the day. But looking at labels is important, but it's also looking at what you're looking out for. Most people just tend to focus on carbohydrates, which that's what I get quite often. It's probably the one thing I don't even get my patients to look at.
Yeah.
Because the body will use that first as that first source of energy. So when they are looking at labels and they're comparing, we always do recommend compare to that 100 gram mark. So you're comparing apples for apples.
Yeah.
Because some Muesli bars will be 25 grams, others will be 30, and you're kind of just having, you're not getting that, I guess, best comparison. But once either a product's been chosen, or if you're walking down the supermarket aisle and you think, hey, that looks good, let me see what it looks like, it's always per serve, because you want to know how much of whatever you're eating you're going to be consuming from your calories, from that carb, protein, fat kind of aspect.
Yeah.
So the big ones to look out for is your energy. So that's first and foremost. So how much energy is this going to give you? And then where's that energy coming from? So the next one would be the fat content.
Yeah.
What we call your saturated fat, as they aren't, they're not good fats to take in. And then I tend to get my patients to look at sugar. Because your carbohydrates, your body will use, whereas the sugar is actually a derivative of that carbohydrate. So that is where you'll either see whether it's added or whether it's coming naturally from the food. And then fiber and sodium are good options, but sometimes fiber is not even on the label. But sodium is a really important one, especially for my heart health patients to look at. So big ones are energy, fat, saturated fat, and sugar. So the big four. And then I do get my patients also to make sure that they're looking at the ingredients list. So it's not just what the numbers say.
Yeah.
But on the ingredients list, by law, it actually has to be listed from the most abundant product and then in descending order.
Okay.
So it really gives the person, I guess, reading that label an idea of, yep, sugar might say it's got 10 in it, but when you look and it's a yogurt, it'll have milk solids, and it might have strawberry, banana, passion fruit, and then it might have some starch in it, and then it might only have sugar. Yeah. They will know that all that sugar is actually coming from all the fruit that's added. It's not actually added sugar. Whereas there will be some yogurts that will have milk solids, sugar, and fruit.
Yeah.
So you'll actually be able to say, okay, well, hey, that sugar is actually all coming from the sugar, not really from the fruit. So if you were choosing which one would be a better option and everything else is kind of the same, I would say go for the one that has that fruit listed first.
That is super, super helpful, not just for bariatric patients. I think all people doing their grocery shopping.
And absolutely. And that's probably when, label reading can actually be so in-depth.
Yeah.
And we, as I said, we go through it with patients. So if patients out there that are seeing their dietitian and they want to learn more about it, we've got examples, we go through it. I'll pick up a couple of things also, usually if they like a Muesli bar that they really like, and I'll show you. Why yes or why no, and we'll do that a little bit more in depth. But big ones: energy, fat, saturated fat, and sugar. Just be aware of, and always check that ingredients list. Look where those what order that ingredients is listed as.
Very cool. Now, I guess even to continue on outside of the actual ingredients themselves, often we see, you know, heart smart checks or, you know, low cal. Tell me, what does that heart 5-star rating sort of, what do those even mean, or how do they pick those kind of labels?
Yeah, good question, because they're everywhere in the supermarket.
They are.
And it really, as again, really confusing for people, just because, I mean, we had the heart tick years and years ago. Now the 5-star ratings come about.
Yeah.
Now each, both heart, the heart tick from the Heart Foundation and the star rating, they have their certain criterias, and for the product to either get the heart tick or get a 5-star rating or get that rating changed, they have to meet certain criteria. The heart tick really does focus, because it's heart health, on your fat content, the trans fats, the salt, and your total energy. So those four are really looked at by the tick,
yeah.
as well as fiber, calcium, and your grains. So your whole grains. So things if there's like nuts or seeds in them, things like that. So you're more what we would old school call complex carbohydrates. I guess we don't usually call them anymore that, but lots of people know that complex carbohydrate. So that's more so where that's coming from. It is very, I guess, heart directed. So a lot more fiber, a lot more grains will help lower cholesterol.
Right.
You want to take in a lot less fat, a lot less sugar to reduce blood pressure. So the heart tick is more so granted products that obviously are lower in fat and trans fat and higher in fiber and lower in salt are all good, healthy options to look at, but definitely more targeted to, I guess, heart health coming
yeah.
through,
yeah.
But can be used by general public either way. The 5-star rating is a little bit more complex.
Mm.
It's not as easy to explain. So they end up looking at things. They do look at energy, saturated fat, but then they look at total sugars and sodium in 100 mils. So they actually take a little bit of a different approach and they kind of work out, I guess, a heart's like a total rating. But then within that total rating, they actually have a point system of how much protein, how much fiber, how much fruit is in there. And then they put it through like a calculation system and then they get their rating. So it's actually a little bit more complex
yeah.
and it's, I guess I was playing around with a couple of, I guess, options of the HeartSmart and also with the tick. I mean, you can also bypass a few things. So there'll always be products that are probably not ideal options that either have a higher rating because, you know, of the protein contents in there that really gives it a high spike, but then it could be very high fat as well.
Right.
They kind of balance each other out. So it would, like, I think they're a good guide
yeah.
for people
yeah.
To use both ways because I think both have their pros and both definitely have their cons and there are loopholes in all these things that kind of get created.
Of course.
But I guess if people are guided towards those, it's then looking at that product and going, okay, well, this says it does have like a 4.5-star rating or it does have the heart tick.
Yeah.
Let me have a look at it. And is it good or right for me? Because just because it's got the heart tick and let's say it's got a 4.5-star rating,
yeah.
It might not be good for someone who is diabetic that's blood sugars will spike with that kind of product.
Yeah.
So I guess, as I said, good guide,
yeah.
Good to know about them. And categories do have to apply and be put into them. So if you don't fit in, you don't fit in.
Yeah.
So that's a really good thing. It's not just something that you can kind of buy and stick onto the product, which is really important. And I think a little bit misleading because I have had a few people ask me that, or people just can buy that for the product.
Mm.
It actually does have to fit into a certain category to, I guess, obtain their ratings either way.
Right.
But then finding out whether that product is actually right for your health needs is
yeah.
the next step from
yeah.
that.
And it sounds like that's sort of an education, and we would go back into what we were previously talking about, looking at those four aspects, which is really, I suppose, the education process that you're bringing to your patients when they come see you.
Absolutely. Yeah, for sure.
Thank you so much for coming onto the podcast and all of the information that you gave us. Super, super helpful, super informative. Really appreciate it. I look forward to having you on the podcast again soon, hopefully.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me. I thoroughly enjoyed it. And yeah, very happy to come back on. So it's been great.
Thank you for tuning into our podcast. For everything you've heard and for special podcast offers, go to www.waelos.com.au/podcast. Right now, all podcast listeners are eligible for a complimentary consultation with Dr. Kevin Dolan. Thank you for listening.